Hello, and welcome to this extra inning of The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan United States Centre here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, Managing Editor of the Phelan US Centre's blog on US politics and policy, USAP. In January 2024, I spoke to Andrew Rudalevich, the Thomas Brackett Reed Professor of Government at Bowdoin College, and visiting professor in the LSE's Department of Government for the 2023-24 academic year. He studies American political institutions, with an emphasis on the modern presidency, the executive branch, and interbranch relations. We spoke about the separation of powers in U.S. government and the executive branch, and former President Trump's potential plans to reshape the federal bureaucracy to create more political appointees, if he is re-elected to the presidency in this year's presidential election. Before we started the interview, I asked Professor Rudalevich to give us an overview of his research.
So my work over time has dealt with different aspects of presidential management, and my dissertation book eons ago dealt with how presidents use their different staffs in the executive branch to create a legislative program, and then what the implications for those formulation patterns were for the success of that legislation once it got to Congress. So I was looking at this broad relationship of the president and Congress, but also the president and the executive branch. And that's sort of where I've settled in my scholarship. I've done a lot of work on how presidents use, for example, the Office of Management and Budget. And sort of a long-term project is to complete an institutional history of the Office of Management and Budget, which is a careerist-dominated staffing agency within the executive office of the president. Very rare. It's not filled with political appointees who come and go with administrations, but rather they do the management, the budgeting, and a lot of the efforts to oversee implementation in the executive branch. And so it's a really interesting agency. It's just over 100 years old, and one that really has gone in different directions over time, but has always been an important part of the president's efforts to manage the bureaucracy. And then my latest work on executive orders has again been a variant of that, right? Presidents tell the bureaucracy to do something. Do they do it? How do they figure out what to tell them to do? And again, going back to an earlier strand of research on bureaucratic politics, you know, what resources do agencies have to either comply or resist, right, with what the president has asked them to do? And how does that affect the formulation of those orders in the first place? So, you know, the thread holding all this together really is sort of the making of public policy in various senses, moving over the course of my career from legislative policy to really executive action, as we've seen that happen in the U.S. and other places too. But the U.S., it's pretty notable how much of the policy making action is now in the executive branch.
So your 2021 book is called By Executive Order, Bureaucratic Management and the Limits of Presidential Power. Looking at the long history of the United States, why has bureaucratic management been such a politically controversial and substantively important issue for various presidents?
Well, this is something that's become increasingly important in the last, let's say, 100 years. Before, let's say, the Great Depression and the New Deal in the U.S. in the 1930s, there wasn't that much national government. And therefore, the powers of the agencies within the national government was relatively limited. Obviously, that varied. You know, the Civil War in the U.S. in the 1860s, you know, really elevated the power of the national government and so on. But on the whole, I think it's safe to say that the administrative state matters less when there's not that much to administer, when responsibilities for governance are actually at, you know, say, the state or local levels of government, which in the U.S., you know, is pretty common. Now, that begins to change in the 20th century. You have the Great Depression, World War II, civil rights movement, and the assumption of the national government's responsibility for enforcing equality under the law. You have a huge wave of regulation over time. And so with all of this, you have the centralization of authority in the national government, which means the federal government's doing more, which gives the president opportunity to take control of that executive branch and achieve his, someday her, preferences. not only does the president have opportunity, they also have means and motive. It's a good mystery story in a lot of ways, right? The means become different executive directives, like executive orders or memoranda to different parts of the executive branch. And the motive, frankly, is that over time, Congress becomes less and less productive. And so in order to have substantive achievements, presidents feel the need to use this big executive branch that does an awful lot of governing to achieve their own policy preferences. They can't count on being able to get a law passed. And so they turn not necessarily to passing new law, but finding new interpretations of older laws that they can use to advance their agenda. And you see this in lots of places, you know, just to take the Biden administration as an example, you see this in the environment, you see it in immigration, you see it in the effort to forgive student loans, for example. So lots of places where there hasn't necessarily been new legislation, but presidents have turned to the statute books and then used their executive authority to try to direct the bureaucracy to act in ways consonant with that directive and with the president's agenda.
Great. Thank you so much. Could you give us a little bit of background on how the separation of powers works in the executive branch and the independence of government agencies? Historically, what were the limits on what the president, what have they been allowed to do?
Yeah, it's a great question and a complicated one, and one that we see, in fact, in front of the Supreme Court right now with regards to how much deference a court should pay to an agency's interpretation of the rules and whether that interpretation is the same as the president's interpretation. We go back to the beginning, the executive branch is effectively created, obviously, in the very broad outline by the Constitution, but in practice, it's created by Congress. Congress creates the departments, they tell the departments what to do, they give them assignments, and frankly, they pay for them. And therefore, you know, people out in the agencies have a lot of interest in what Congress has to say. Presidents come and go. Members of Congress stick around for a long time. So do bureaucrats and civil servants. There's at least, you know, in the jargon, there's a multiple principle problem, right, for the president. The president is the chief executive on paper, but in fact, the different bureaus and agencies have a lot of incentive to pay attention to other people, including Congress, including their constituencies out in the interest group world. The press, lots of other people who, you know, might or might not be in sort of congruent with what the president wants to do. And so to the degree that those different actors disagree, bureaucrats actually have some running room to do what they want. And again, they have their own agenda set in law. So to some degree, they have to act in a certain way because that's what the law tells them to do. If the president says, actually, I'd like you to do something different, that gets tricky very quickly. The other aspect of this, and it becomes important, is sort of what control the president has over personnel. And that is something that, again, is a complicated story. On the one hand, clearly the president appoints the heads of agencies, and those people are confirmed by the Senate. But there is nonetheless a clear sort of line of direction between the president and what we might call the line agencies. But then there are all these other agencies that were created to be buffered from the president, different regulatory agencies, often called the independent regulatory commissions. And they're not exactly independent. They are in the executive branch, but they're often made up of a multi-member board rather than one director. And those people have fixed terms. That is to say, the president just can't get rid of them if he feels like it. And often there are some qualifications associated. So whereas theoretically the president can appoint anyone he wants to become Secretary of the Treasury, assuming the Senate will go along, that's not always true in some of these regulatory positions where they might be associated with certain levels of qualifications or perhaps even party identification. The Federal Election Commission, for example, is designed to be neutral. So there are supposed to be three Democrats and three Republicans. And of course, on the one hand, that makes it neutral. On the other hand, it also may make it impotent and completely gridlocked if you have a period of partisan polarization. So there's different arguments about how good government this is or whether this represents good government. But there are clearly sort of gradations in how much control the president has over the executive branch. One other thing I'll mention is regulation. Regulation is something that comes out of statute. So Congress passes a law and it will say, well, we don't know everything that's going to happen in the future. And so we need to leave some flexibility in the law. let's say, the Clean Air Act, right? We know we want to protect the environment, but we don't know exactly how to do it and what the proper level of given pollutant might be. How much lead is safe in your water, right? We don't know that. We're in Congress, but the experts in the Environmental Protection Agency should be able to figure that out. And so then the EPA is tasked in law with producing regulations that implement the law. And it's important to note that that power is given in law to the agencies, not to the president. And so there are tools that presidents have to try to shape what those regulations look like. But again, at least in statute, there's a buffer there as well. So, you know, again, we think of the president as chief executive, head honcho in the huge executive branch, you know, 4 million people, depending on how you count them. And yet, you know, this has always been a kind of a troubled relationship. Presidents often say, do this, do that. And from their perspective, too often, nothing happens.
Thank you. I just wanted to go back quickly to when you were talking about executive orders. Those aren't permanent, are they? A succeeding president doesn't necessarily have to follow them. They can change them or even rescind them. Is that correct?
That is correct. They have the force of law while they are in effect. But you're absolutely correct. The next president can just cancel them out with another executive order. So they don't have any lasting permanence. Of course, statute itself doesn't have permanence. Congress passes a law. The next Congress could repeal it. But that's a lot harder to do, right? That especially where you have sort of some consensus around passing a law, usually those laws last for a while. Executive orders, yeah, they are much more short term, or can be. I mean, some of them last for quite a while. But on the whole, they are, you know, if you are a president looking to your long term legacy, executive orders are not the greatest tool for that. We've seen, you know, just in recent years, you know, when Barack Obama comes into office, he repeals a lot of George W. Bush orders. Donald Trump can't wait to start signing repeals of Barack Obama orders. Joe Biden, likewise, you know, most of what he does his first week in office is to get rid of things that Donald Trump had put in place. And presumably Biden's successor, if it's a Republican, will do the same to him. So, again, you know, these can be short term. And so to that degree, when people think of executive orders as, you know, being monstrously powerful, that can be true in the short term, but it's not always a great long term tactic for presidents to use.
Thank you. Going back to the you were talking about the civil service and political appointees, how far down in these agencies, in these organizations, do you have to go before you get to a sort of a non-political civil servant?
Yeah, the U.S. is pretty unusual in this regard. We have a lot more political appointees than most places. You know, whereas in the U.K. civil service, you might have one or two levels of political appointees above the secretaries who make up the higher ranks of the civil service. In the U.S., you could easily have 8 or 10 levels of appointee and then others who are sort of spread throughout an agency. So we have, of course, you know, the secretary of a cabinet department, but then there's usually a deputy secretary, an undersecretary, various assistant secretaries, deputy assistant secretaries. There's a book by a scholar named Paul Light called it's called The Thickening of Government or something like that. And he actually has sort of a comical table where he shows just how many levels of title you could have, you know, as the assistant, deputy assistant secretary to, you know, the Commerce Department or to some bureau within it. So when a president comes into office, they need to come up with, you know, something like 4,000 or 5,000 appointees. You know, and nobody knows that many people, let's face it. And therefore, they're, you know, at a disadvantage already. John F. Kennedy reputedly said, I don't know any people, I only know voters. And I think most presidents have found that to be an issue, which means the transition becomes very important because you have to identify people who will be, you know, both, we hope, competent, but also responsive to the president in those offices. But it means, again, the civil service. I mean, there are certainly people who are careerists within the merit-based civil service in the U.S., which is huge, of course. You know, even all those appointees are only a drop in the bucket when it comes to a big appointment. Let's say you have a couple of hundred appointments at the Department of Agriculture. Well, there are 100,000 people working at the Department of Agriculture, give or take. So, you know, again, when you're talking about a span of control or something like that, it's those appointees don't necessarily help you with better management or at least control. But those civil servants, you know, there are lots of them. According to sort of recent musings, certainly in the Republican side of the think tank world, there are too many civil servants. There should be more political appointments, in fact, at the sort of decision-making levels of middle management. And we'll see where that comes out, you know, after the 2024 election, perhaps. But yeah, it's a system that has many more political appointees than most systems. But that doesn't necessarily give the president the control that he craves.
So in a recent article for Good Authority, you wrote about the unitary executive theory. Can you talk a bit about what this theory is and why it's relevant for understanding various Republicans' proposals for reshaping the executive branch?
So the unitary executive theory is something that is both old and new. I mean, in one sense, right, it comes from the idea that you have one president. Which, by the way, was kind of controversial in 1787 when people are sitting around in Philadelphia sweltering in the Constitutional Convention. You know, James Wilson, one of the delegates, gets up and says, you know, we should have, I move that we have a president of the United States, right? There had been no executive branch in the government prior, you know, to that. The pre-constitutional government is extremely weak in the United States. So, the notes on the convention by James Madison say something like, his proposal was met with silence, right? Everybody's, that sounds, yeah, it's not, I mean, we like that idea. We need an executive, we know, but you know, we've just had a king. You know, we don't actually want to restore the monarchy. We want to be careful about what we do in that regard. We don't want to empower tyrants. It's apparently Benjamin Franklin, who's, you know, ancient by that point, kind of sitting in a corner snoozing most of the time. But he says, yeah, let's talk about this. This is important. And that gets things going. And ultimately, of course, they do adopt a single president, a president of the United States, in whom the executive power is vested. That's the first line of Article 2 of the Constitution. The executive power is vested in a president of the United States. So what does that mean? Well, obviously, it depends on what the executive power is. So the presidency is unitary in a kind of trivial sense, a definitional sense. There's one president, not a plural presidency, not a council of advisors that have constitutional rights to order the president around, right? So one president, in that sense, unitary. And Alexander Hamilton, in his Federalist Papers, you know, argues that's pretty important because it's important for accountability, if nothing else. You need to know who is making decisions. And one person can make decisions much more effectively than many people, right? The president can make decisions faster and if necessary, in secret compared to Congress, say, which takes forever, even in a good day. And of course, you know, can't keep a secret at all. But that's good. They have different roles, right? But so in that sense, unity in the executive is sort of theoretically important. But what does it mean in practice? Well, again, what does the executive power mean? James Wilson, the same guy who talked about having a single president, said, well, what I think it means is the ability to appoint people in the administration, in the executive, and the ability to execute the law. And that's it, right? If you go down the road a ways, right, people who have pushed for sort of a theory of a unitary executive have kind of mushed those a little bit. They've said in order to execute the laws, the president needs to be able to control personnel, and therefore anybody in the executive branch who acts must be subject to presidential control, which is to say the president has to be able to hire and especially fire them. And we can talk a little more about sort of the notion of who the president can fire and who he can't. But the notion of presidential removal for those scholars, you know, tends to be pretty important. So they would argue, you know, the unitary executive branch means that the president is responsible for everything that happens in the executive branch and therefore has to be able to have his own people there and has to be able to get rid of people who don't obey. So, for example, those people with fixed terms or, you know, different qualifications, that in those scholars' view is kind of out of bounds, even unconstitutional, because it means the president can't control them to the degree that they think he ought to be able to. Now, another twist on this comes over time. I would identify it really with the sort of George W. Bush administration, where suddenly not only is this a question of personnel, but it's of power more broadly. And how do we define the executive power, well, we would define it really broadly when it comes to war powers, for example. We would say that if Congress wants to pass a law banning the use of torture by the United States, well, sorry, you can't do that because the president is commander in chief in the Constitution. We're at war with terror. And therefore, if the president feels that torture is needed, then he has to be able to override that law. And so you have legal opinions in the Bush administration that effectively purport to set aside congressionally passed law on the grounds that it violates, you know, the president's constitutional authority, which they have wrapped up into the executive power, which in turn is justified by this unitary executive theory. So there's sort of two parts of it. I think it's uncontroversial to say the president, you know, is the president and has executive power. It becomes much more controversial when you say that only the president has authority and Congress especially cannot impinge upon the workings of the executive branch. Can't pass a law, you know, controlling the way the president does things. And that is much trickier to justify, I think, certainly as a matter of American history, but even as a matter of constitutional doctrine, because we come back to the separation of powers. We come back to the fact that Congress, again, creates the bureaucracy, creates the executive branch, is the sole method of getting money in the American government. You know, the appropriation of funds is the only way that you can spend money. Congress has the power to tax and then to spend. Again, those are not executive branch powers. So, you know, it seems odd to then say, well, but Congress can't interfere with the workings of the executive branch when the, you know, the workings of the system seem to be built so that it is a, you know, what was said in another context, an invitation to struggle between the branches of government. And so, denying Congress's ability to act is sort of a step, from my perspective, a step too far. I think the Constitution is not Unitarian. It's devoutly Trinitarian.
Great. Thanks so much. I'd like to pick up on that a little bit. You talk about the struggle between Congress and executive power. My understanding is that the Supreme Court is basically the referee for these kinds of disputes, but they're kind of an equal member of government, as it were. I guess what I'm trying to ask is, does that put the Supreme Court in a position, a higher position than the other two branches, in terms of they're able to decide between a dispute between Congress and the presidency, but then the Supreme Court can be obviously influenced by the presidency in terms of appointments of judges. Where do you sort of stand on that, those kind of disputes, and where the various parts sit?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, in part because recent developments have shown the court to be hugely influential in terms of these disputes when Congress and the president can't agree. I think the court usually, though not always, is reluctant to wade into the minutiae of congressional presidential argumentation. Normally in history, you've had some ability between the so-called political branches to work out their problems, whether that's about executive privilege, that is to say, what kind of information the president has to give to Congress, or other issues of presidential power, war powers, for example, have generally been worked out in practice. And so the courts in recent years have been forced into a position. Again, some appointees have welcomed this, others not so much. Been put in a position where they are really the last line of decision making, because there are these sort of difficult questions that can't be resolved in any other forum. So again, the courts are not political in the sense that once a Supreme Court justice, and by the way, the Supreme Court is a tiny fraction of the American judiciary, right? You've got, you know, hundreds of judges at lower levels, you know, in the federal system. And so the Supreme Court is only handling, you know, 70, 80 cases a year. There are thousands, of course, of cases that come through the system overall. But their cases are naturally pretty important and pretty salient and have a lot to do with interpreting both the law, that is to say, you know, when a president says, oh, I found this old law, can I use it to do this? You know, the court has to decide, well, did the president read that law correctly? Is that within the text? Is it within the meaning of the law? And of course, there's a lot of arguments about that. Court also has to deal with these broader issues of constitutionality and how to interpret the Constitution. We're seeing that right now with the 14th Amendment, right? People hadn't necessarily paid a lot of attention to the third section of the 14th Amendment dealing with insurrection and how that might make somebody unqualified to hold federal office. And suddenly different states are looking at that language and going, well, we think that applies to Donald Trump. And suddenly the Supreme Court has to come to some decision. I wouldn't say that makes them higher than the other branches. It does make them a political branch themselves. I think we do ourselves a disservice if we think of them as, I mean, they built themselves a big white marble temple, right? It's like a Greek temple. They're supposed to be gods. That was sort of implicit in the architecture. I challenge our listeners to look at a photo of the Supreme Court and go, yes, I wish to worship these people. This is a not just the current court, but any court throughout history. The court is political. It's shaped, of course, by its appointments. It's shaped by public opinion. It's shaped, we hope, by its interpretation of the law. But those are things that can evolve over time, right, as different doctrines evolve. And so, you know, I don't think we should hold them, you know, up as necessarily, you know, independent arbiters free of any ideology. I do think what makes sense is actually to go to a model where the president and Congress are figuring out their own problems. And by the way, Congress and the president do have their own role in assessing the constitutionality of different measures. The court, obviously, way back in 1803, in a famous case called Marbury v. Madison, decided that, you know, it had the right to say what the law is. And that, you know, case is cited over and over again. They drenched themselves in the perfume of Marbury v. Madison, right? But that said, the other branches of government, you know, must have some responsibility for figuring out what's constitutional. And you see both Congress and the presidency trying to, make those calls. I do think, you know, it would be probably a better quality of governance if Congress would return to difficult issues and legislate about them rather than pushing that into the executive branch, forcing subsequent presidents to use their executive authority to try to shape implementation of different law in perhaps radically different ways, right? The whiplash between the Obama and Trump and Biden administrations on different issues of policy has been kind of painful. So, you know, if what we want is sort of a stable interpretation of governance and a way to adapt to the times, it would make a lot more sense for Congress to act, again, given the sort of partisan structures in the U.S., it's hard to do right now. And so, you know, that has elevated the role of the court beyond what it probably should be.
I'd just like to go back to our discussion about the executive, because in his campaigns in between being president, Donald Trump has talked a lot about reshaping the U.S. Civil Service. And he's used terms like Schedule F. And I believe there's something called Project 2025 that he's working. Can you talk a bit about what those are, what those plans might look like if they were able to be rolled out, and whether or not they'd be able to be rolled out?
Sure. Yeah, certainly President Trump, you know, while he was in office, felt that he was stymied in his efforts to achieve his agenda by the so-called resistance. Often he would rail against the deep state, right? Which is just an insulting term for the administrative state. But it does, you know, get at the notion that there are a lot of people out there. It's broad, maybe, rather than deep, but it's not quibble. Anyway, the question here was, you know, these were, by the way, the people resisting the president were people he appointed, as well as the you know, career civil service. So this was a little bit of a you know, not entirely well-reasoned argument, but nonetheless, what the president took away from this was the need to, you know, have people who would do what he wanted in key positions, and to expand the number of people that he could control. And so Schedule F emerged at the very end of the Trump administration as a effectively an amendment to the civil service regulations that would reclassify certain positions in the civil service as more or less at-will appointees. There are still some protections. They're not supposed to be fired solely on the basis of partisan affiliation, for example. But there's no question it would make it much easier for a president to remove people. Again, these were aimed at policy decision-oriented positions, right? A lot. So it'd be a lot of people who are sort of making decisions about regulations, about legal interpretations, effectively sort of upper middle management, I would say, at a lot of agencies where those positions are held by careerists. And so, again, converting those positions to what are, you know, largely political appointments would obviously give the president more control, because right now you tell the president something he doesn't want to hear and you're in one of these positions, you're protected. You can't be fired simply for reminding the president that this is a silly idea. Under the Schedule F, again, that's just another, you know, it would go after Schedule E. And the civil service regulations would be, under Schedule F, the president could say, well, no, I don't like what you just told me. You're fired. And that would be, you know, a big shift in the way that the U.S. government works. And it would certainly, it would do two things. It would probably ensure that civil servants were less brave, frankly, about telling the president the facts on the ground. And it would, over time, devalue expertise as those people were replaced by people who were loyal to the president, but not necessarily hugely expert in the subject matter that they were dealing with in their agency, which is the point, after all, of giving agencies autonomy in the first place, is to make sure you can rely on neutral competence, neutral expertise, to help you achieve your goals. So again, if Schedule F were implemented, estimates vary because it wasn't fully implemented at the end of the Trump administration. Joe Biden rescinded it, yet another executive order that was rescinded quickly in 2021. But there were estimates of, let's say, 50,000 positions that this would apply to. So, you know, I mentioned there are about four to 5,000 appointments the president has to make. This would ramp that up drastically. And, you know, if it were put in place, and it could be, I think it's not clear, you know, the legality of this is a little unclear, right? The civil service regulations come out of civil service law, and some argue that Congress would have to amend the law to make this possible. But there are some precedents where presidents have played around at the edges with the civil service, created new categories of employee. Dwight Eisenhower did this back in the 1950s with Schedule C to allow there to be additional sort of political appointees at lower levels within the different agencies. So I do think it's a plausible thing for President Trump to pursue. I don't think it would actually be very good for governance. And frankly, I don't even think it would be very good for President Trump's ability to achieve his agenda. Because if you look at the history of 2017 to 2021, President Trump had very few policy successes in Congress. Where he was able to make change, and important changes in some ways, was through executive action. And that was done largely through that same deep state. I've written elsewhere that, President Trump's songs about the deep state should be love songs, you know, not harangues. They came up with ways for him to build the wall and to block immigration during the pandemic, and to, you know, work on, you know, his trade barriers against China, and for that matter, the EU and other allies. Those were all things that, the permanent government came up with as ways that were legal. I mean, whether or not they thought they were good ideas, they told the president, look, if this is what you want to do, this is how you can do it legally. Again, I think you'll find that people brought in, you know, on the grounds of being loyal to Donald Trump, are not necessarily going to be able to find those tools. And so they may actually do less rather than more to advance the president's agenda.
Thank you. Do you want to say a few words about Project 2025 as well, or does that sort of encompass with what you've...
Sure. Well, Project 2025 is sort of a joint project from a number of think tanks on the right, some of them Trump alumni, notably Russ Vought, who was the head of the Office of Management and Budget in the executive office of the president at the tail end of the Trump administration. OMB, by the way, was one of the few agencies that did begin to implement Schedule F. Again, that was reversed pretty quickly. So he and some other former Trump appointees have created a think tank, the Heritage Foundation, which is a longer standing partisan think tank that was pretty instrumental back in the Reagan administration in creating its agenda. It's moved probably more sharply into the Trump camp, away from, say, the Reagan wing of the Republican Party. And so, you know, in conjunction with each other, there's been a lot of discussion about finding people who would be good appointees, right? Creating a data set of people who they could bring in who would be loyal to this agenda, and to different mechanisms for controlling the executive branch, right? Some version of Schedule F is high on that list. Some version of trying to control the independent agencies I talked about earlier, right? Perhaps going with a full bore challenge constitutionally to those agencies, saying, look, the president has to be able to fire everybody. And it's wrong to have some protections for some positions. So there are definitely, you know, moves afoot, sort of in the intellectual side of the Republican Party, certainly on the sort of the Trump wing of that party, to try to give any Republican president, but I think they're expecting it to be a President Trump, the tools to implement more control over the executive branch. Another element of this that's gotten some attention is sort of removing elements of independence from the Justice Department, right? And again, the independence that the Justice Department has is really a matter of norms coming out of the Watergate scandal in the 1970s and efforts to make sure that prosecution is depoliticized rather than law. The Justice Department is an agency and the president has control, you know, over its personnel. But it goes against, you know, 50 years of practice to say the president should be able to call up the attorney general and say, you need to charge X with Y crime. And that's, I think, what the, you know, Project 2025, taken to an extreme, would justify the president's being able to do that. So, again, the Trump campaign itself has distanced itself a little bit, you know, from these efforts. They've been, you know, leery of saying that somebody else is writing their agenda for them. But it would be hard to imagine that at least some of the people involved would not come back into a second Trump administration and have a fair bit of sway to try to implement that agenda. It has to be said that President Trump the first time around was not hugely interested in the details of governance, but there are people around him who are, and frankly, they'll be better at it this time around.
Thank you. I'd just like to pick up on that point about governance just for my next kind of two-part question. You've talked a little bit about what constrained Trump from introducing these sorts of Schedule F type measures during his presidency. Can you talk a bit more about what stopped Trump from doing these sorts of things that he wants to do in his second presidency if he was to gain the White House again once again? And if he does win in November, are these sorts of policies, these measures, are they likely to be challenged in all the way up to the Supreme Court, for example? Are they likely to stand? Or do you think there we would be stuck with them?
It's hard to talk about it with a broad brush because there are so many different strands to this. And I think almost all of them would be challenged, but some probably have a better chance of sticking than others. You know, as I mentioned, I think something like Schedule F, you know, would be challenged in court almost immediately because, you know, at the moment, you know, manager X in a given agency has some kind of, you know, vested rights in their job, and to change that without, you know, due process of law could be challenged, you know, in the courts. Again, Congress could certainly change it, but Congress hasn't shown much interest in civil service reform for nigh on 50 years. Would that court challenge work? I honestly don't know. I think that the change in Schedule F is a lot bigger than the one that was contemplated back in the 1950s with Schedule C, but it's certainly not impossible that Supreme Court, which at the moment is not that excited about bureaucratic autonomy, let's face it, they're actually pretty more excited about ways of reining in bureaucratic autonomy. You know, that could be something that does stick, frankly. You know, when you're talking about, you know, almost any of these things, I think there will be challenges in Congress. And so one of the big wild cards, of course, is what is the makeup of Congress? You know, is there a sort of Trumpist majority in the Senate and the House? Is there, know, if the Democrats retook the House in the 2024 election, even as Donald Trump won, which is certainly not implausible, you could, you know, you'd have an automatic break, you know, on funding, for example, for some of these proposals. It's hard to know exactly how that's going to play out and therefore what the level of support will be. A lot will depend on the political environment. But, you know, I think President Trump restored to office, you know, I don't think anybody can say they don't know what's coming. Right. He would be able to claim a political mandate in ways that he could not do in 2016. Again, he would be better prepared, I think, to, you know, seed the executive branch with loyalists. A lot of the people that he put in place in 2017, you know, were sort of, they were not Trumpists per se. They were good Republicans. They'd worked in prior administrations. Many had worked in the military. You know, they were interested, you know, as actually Jared Kushner put it, Donald Trump's son-in-law, said a lot of them, you know, wanted to save the world from Trump rather than thinking that Trump would save the world. I suspect that will shift, right? The people that will be brought in, they won't be the so-called grown-ups in the room who will be able to tell the president, nah, that's a bad idea. We can't do that. The law says otherwise. History says otherwise. It's a political loser. You know, I think that, you know, that check at least will probably be lessened, if not removed. And so, you know, you will have less pushback within the executive branch. Again, what does the Senate look like? Do they actually confirm, you know, leaders of that stripe for different agencies? You could see them doing so again in a Republican Senate, but almost certainly not in a democratically led Senate. So these individual state races suddenly become very important to the way, I mean, it's already important, of course, the Electoral College, but they become very important to the likely payoffs of the next president too, and how much they'd be able to achieve. Then finally, as you suggest, I think the courts will play a very important backstop role, because to the degree that Congress remains gridlocked, you know, President Trump will be using acting appointees. He will be issuing a lot of executive orders and other forms of unilateral directives to the agencies. And, you know, interest groups, you know, Democrats in Congress and the like will be, you know, bringing those questions to court, saying you can't do that. Similar to the way that interest groups brought Biden's efforts to forgive student loans to court and were successful at the Supreme Court level. You know, so there'll be a lot of things I would imagine in immigration, in environmental policy, in, you know, the use, another thing we haven't talked about, the discussed anyway, the use of the military to control protests and other things in the U.S. You know, now Congress could do a lot to in advance to sort of stave off worries about those things. You know, you could reform the Immigration Act. You could reform the what's so-called Insurrection Act. You could reform the National Emergencies Act, reform the War Powers Resolution. A lot of statutes that were designed to sort of regulate presidential power, but over time actually have activated it and provided sort of a weird incentive for presidents to act, because it takes a two-thirds votes of Congress to overturn their action. There have been discussions in Congress about, for example, reforming the National Emergencies power so that an emergency only lasts for a short while before it has to be affirmatively endorsed by Congress, rather than the current situation, which is where, say, President Trump declares an emergency at the southern border in order to unlock funding and other powers. And the only way Congress can prevent that emergency from moving forward is by passing a resolution. That resolution is vetoed. And of course, then they need a two-thirds vote in each chamber to overturn that veto. So it's a, you know, it's a, the default is backwards, I think. And you could, in fact, see some moves towards congressional reform in that area. But I think that would have to happen before the election, because, you know, a reelected President Trump would certainly veto those measures. And by the way, even President Biden would not be enthusiastic about them. All presidents want more power, right? You know, presidents don't get elected on a pledge of limiting themselves. You know, that was the platform of the Whig presidents in the 1840s. But it's been a long time since presidents thought, you know, the best way to move forward would be for me to do less. And you'll see that in the campaign, right? Every every candidate says, on day one, I will do 2,000 different things all by the stroke of my pen. And, you know, even if those don't all come into being, you know, those sort of expectations are raised. And when presidents then find themselves unable to act, you know, you see, you know, sort of disappointment in the ranks. We've been betrayed. It just leads to more cynicism in government. So this is a long way of saying, I think things will not be great, even if some of the worst things don't come to pass, because you will have sort of made promises that can't be kept to your electorate.
And just for my final question, really, you've been talking about the sort of the need for Congress to take action to sort of maybe address some of these issues. You know, we're sitting in January 2024. The Republicans' congressional majority, I think, is half a dozen at most. It's very small. And we are seeing quite slim majorities in the Senate as well from both parties in this cycle. There's a lot of political polarization. Gridlock is a term that's being used almost every day. What are the chances for congressional action in these, on these issues, especially when, as you say, it needs a two-thirds majority in the House to override a presidential veto? Is there any hope there?
Two-thirds in the House and the Senate, even worse. So yes, but that said, I'm not entirely unhopeful. There have been discussions, both in Congress and in various institutions outside of Congress, about ways of sort of bolstering Article 1. There's usually some kind of title, you know, for these efforts, you know, along those lines, or restoring Article 1, you know, rejuvenating Article 1. You know, Article 1 is the part of the Constitution that created Congress. And so, you know, how do you get Congress to use the powers it already has? Because it clearly does have a lot of authority. It's been a question of either failing to use it or indeed delegating that power to the president over time and making that office more powerful relative to Congress. So, you know, why am I slightly hopeful? Well, in a number of areas, there have been pretty substantive discussions about this. One, as I mentioned, the National Emergencies Act. Related to that, the War Powers Resolution and the authorization for the use of military force that was passed back in 2001 after the September 11th attacks on the U.S., right? That law, which gave the president a good deal of delegated authority to fight the war against al-Qaeda, as they thought at the time, has been expanded in lots of different directions, you know, geographically, ideologically. You know, I don't know how many degrees of separation are required for a group in the president's estimation not to count as some version of al-Qaeda, but it seems like kind of a stretchy piece of legislation, and members of Congress have gotten a little impatient with that over time. So we see action there, perhaps repealing that, replacing it with a more time-limited authorization that's more specific to the foes that are actually being fought in 2023 and 4, as opposed to, 2001. You see some efforts around budgeting and budget reform, though those are really, I think, kind of held up on the shoals of these narrow majorities. As you say, it's very difficult to get a budget passed. U.S. doesn't have a budget right now, right? It's operating under a so-called continuing resolution that kind of keeps last year's funding in place for another 2 weeks, for another month, for another 3 months. So budget reform, I think, is harder and less likely. But I do think, you know, members of Congress, you know, they were able to come together and pass, for example, reforms to the Electoral Count Act, which we saw, you know, was a flashpoint in, you know, January 2021. Donald Trump urged his vice president to interpret the Electoral Count Act as it existed then to effectively overturn the results of the election. Vice President Pence, to his great credit, did not do that. But Congress did come together and change that law to make it clearer as to what has to happen and to make it much harder for states to manipulate the electoral vote. Again, we've seen some coming together on, you know, these different delegations of power, whether it's the war powers or emergency powers. And, you know, a lot of this is about, it shouldn't theoretically be partisan, because if you're a member of Congress, you have an institutional interest in your own authority. But, you know, I have to confess, right, these things do become closely aligned. It's great when my president acts unilaterally. It's dictatorship when your president acts unilaterally. And we have to try to, I think, give members of Congress more incentives to act, in a way that endorses sort of institutional pride in their own prerogatives rather than to rubber stamp whatever a president of their own party wants to do. Again, you're right. It's harder when the margins are so narrow, and when sort of one vote, the other aspect of, the margins being narrow is that each party thinks it can win next time around. And they're probably right. We've seen all kinds of weird combinations of divided government in the last number of years. And so, if you, think you can hold a majority next time, why would you do anything that would help the current majority? We might, probably seeing this in immigration policy right now in the United States, right? It's probably better for Republicans to have terrible immigration policy at the moment because that's Joe Biden's fault. And if they gave him the tools to fix it through the talks that are going on now, well, then it might actually get better. And then what will the campaign ads be about? Right. So there are weird incentives in place to sort of defray bipartisan cooperation. That said, again, I'm hopeful to the degree that we've seen some of that happening already. We've seen some efforts to sort of even in Congress, there's a committee created to sort of think about congressional resources, better staffing, better ability to push back against the president when the president's legal team says, yes, I can do this. And so, again, I think it'll be I think this is a longer term project. Back in the 1970s, we have, the example of sort of the Watergate in Vietnam era leading to a real sea change, right? What I've called elsewhere the resurgence regime of Congress, really creating a whole number of laws that did change or purported or hoped to change the relationship of the Congress to the president. Congress tried to deal itself back in to a lot of areas. Most of those laws over time have, I think, either failed utterly or failed by the fact that Congress has backed away from actually enforcing them. I hope it doesn't take another Watergate / Vietnam to prompt similar levels of reform. But I suppose that's yet another thing we could look forward to in 2025 under the right political circumstances.
Right. Thanks so much. Just finally, I just wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about any research you're working on at the moment, anything our listeners should look out for from you coming up soon.
Sure. Well, you mentioned The Good Authority, which is a blog that used to be the Monkey Cage blog on the Washington Post website and has now been spun off into an independent site. And so I've been writing quasi-regularly for them about different issues of executive authority. And so readers who are looking for, sort of primers or explainers on different pieces of the presidency are encouraged to go over to goodauthority.org and take a look there. That's part of a larger project I'm working on to try to sort of lay out a taxonomy of executive authority, actually, to try to redefine the executive power in the current era. And again, that comes to a lot of the things we've talked about appointments, about efforts by the president to manage the wider executive branch, hiring and firing of personnel, use of executive directives of various kinds, the use of regulation, the war powers again comes back into this. But really, when we talk about the president as chief executive in 2024 and looking forward, what do we mean by that? What are the actual authorities the president might have? Even longer term, right? Working on a history of the Office of Management and Budget, which, as mentioned, is kind of an important advisory staff to the president within the executive branch. What's unique about OMB is that it is filled with civil servants and not political appointees, really the only part of the executive office of the president where that's true. A century into that agency's existence, I'm intrigued by how it's evolved over time, how it's been used by different presidents, and again, how it has, survived the whiplash, between Bush and Obama and Trump and Biden and who knows what looking forward.
Sounds fascinating and incredibly relevant. Thank you so much for speaking to us at the Ballpark today.
Great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Andrew Rudilevich is a Thomas Brackett Reed Professor of Government at Bowdoin College and visiting professor in the LSE's Department of Government for the 2023-24 academic year. And that's it for this extra inning of the ballpark. Thanks so much to Andrew Rudilevich for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan US Centre, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On Twitter and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US, and on Facebook, we're LSE United States. This extra inning was produced by Chris Gilson and Anderson Tan. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk or send us a tweet at @LSE_US and tell your friends about us. You can also leave us a review on your podcast app of choice. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan US Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.